little introduction to Bonhoeffer's book on Essex. Dolores told me that at the second breakfast, Carroll, as he at times is wont to do, became a little exuberant and said something about me being the foremost authority on Bonhoeffer, something or other, and I'd like to begin with a disclaimer on that. I'm sure that's not necessary, but... anyway, I'll say some things and we'll have some time for conversation. In a session the other morning, we're talking about ethics, and Dale asked, what is ethics? And I appreciate that question. Maybe you should say that again, that the word is to the Christian life what theology is to the Christian faith. That is, if one talks about faith and theology, faith is receiving God's gift, it's believing in Jesus, it's opening one's hands for God's gifts, it is the occasion on which one becomes a Christian, there are all kinds of ways to talk about faith, but theology is not faith. No one is saved by or with or through or under or anything theology. Theology is thinking about faith, it's reflecting upon faith. It is putting the content of the faith into some kind of structure, some kind of form in which it can be talked about and reflected upon. So one can also distinguish between the Christian life and Christian ethics, where the Christian life is loving the neighbor, giving a cup of cold water, helping old ladies across the street, whatever one does as a Christian. And ethics is thinking about that, it's reflecting upon it, talking about it, getting some words and sentences and categories by which it can be talked about. So we're talking today about Bonhoeffer's ethics, and I think we want to do that in two ways. We want to talk about it in general, that is in terms of his life and writings in general, but also in terms of a book, which is entitled Ethics by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So we're going to work our way into that book a little gradually by saying some things about him, and then we'll look at some specific passages. We'll have some time for conversation. It is always the case in a group like this, I presume it is today also, some of you know a great deal about Bonhoeffer, some of you know virtually nothing. And so it's necessary, I guess, to say some few little things about who he is. It's conceivable that some of you may have never heard his name. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German pastor, actually, and theologian. He was born in 1906, and he was killed by the Nazis in 1945. Made him 39 years old, and those 39 years were packed with all kinds of stuff. Briefly, he had his theological education. He taught for a brief time at the University of Berlin. He served for some time as a pastor of German congregations in England. He had a significant year in the United States at Union Theological Seminary. He came back from the United States on a second trip in 1939, and worked for an outfit which called itself the Confessing Church in Germany. And these people were people who opposed a group which was known as the German Christians. And the German Christians were people who amalgamated Nazism and Christianity. And the Confessing Church people were people who said, no, that's not Christianity. We have to confess Jesus Christ concretely. And they were responsible for a number of things, including the Barmen Confession of 1934, which now stands as one of the confessional statements of the Church of Berlin-Brandenburg, along with Luther's Small Catechism, Augsburg Confession, and so on. He worked with an illegal seminary training pastors for this confessing church. And that lasted for a while. It was finally closed up. This was actually from about 35 to 39. I think I said he started that in 39 before. That was wrong. It was about 35 to 39. Came back to Germany in 1939 from a brief trip to the U.S. and worked as a kind of undercover double agent for the military intelligence. It's a very complicated and weird story. And he did that until 1943, when he was arrested by the Nazis, and he was in prison various places and put to death in 1945. There are two big issues in Bonhoeffer interpretation that should perhaps be mentioned and that Bonhoeffer interpreters disagree about. One of those is the question of continuity and change. That is, there are those people who read Bonhoeffer, who look at his life and his writings, and who decide that there is an impressive continuity, that he really says at the end, even when he's talking about non-religious Christianity, essentially the same thing that he says at the beginning, that there is an incredible integrity to his life and work, and that although there's growth and development, there's some change in language, the big thing is continuity. I happen to be with those people. So is Eberhard Bethge, his biographer and the friend to whom he wrote the letters from prison, the editor of this book entitled Ethics, and so on. But there are people who say, no, the continuities are not very impressive. What is really impressive is the radical change in his life. And they see that change taking place late in life, some of them as late as his imprisonment. And some of these people are William Hamilton, who was in the so-called Death of God movement, another fellow by the name of Hanfred Müller, who is a professor in East Berlin, and who has a book on Bonhoeffer entitled From the Church to the World. And these people see Bonhoeffer as beginning as a pious believer, but abandoning the church in order to embrace the world. I happen to disagree with that position. And I think that Bonhoeffer embraces world and church from the beginning to the end, but that's a major conflict in Bonhoeffer interpretation. And if you read the secondary literature, you ought to be aware of that particular difference of opinion. A second major issue in Bonhoeffer interpretation is, given either continuity or change, what's the nub? What's the crux? What's the hub of the wheel? What is the focus of all of this stuff? Bonhoeffer wrote most of his stuff on the run. Apart from his two early dissertations, most of it is done even a little bit haphazardly. And so one has to ask, what is it really all about? And some people say what it's really all about is the church, and one can make a good case for that. Some people say what it's really all about is Christology. Who is Jesus Christ? One can make a very good case for that. Some people would say what it is really all about is the worldly life. One could make a good case for that. There is also, I think, some kind of growing consensus that would place the focus at the word reality. That is to say, what Bonhoeffer is really concerned about from beginning to end is what's really real. That the most objectionable thing for Bonhoeffer is to live in a world of illusion, in a dream world. He wants to taste and to touch and to feel and to sense and to live in what's really real. And he believes that Jesus Christ is the entree into what's really real. I happen to be with those people who see that focus. There are a number of secondary books on Bonhoeffer that have come out within the last 5-6 years that focus on reality. Heinrich Ott, who is the successor to Karl Barth in the University of Bonn, has a book on Bonhoeffer entitled Reality and Faith. Larry Rasmussen, Wesley Seminary in Washington, D.C., has a book that's in the bookstore here entitled Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Reality and Resistance. André Dumas, University of Paris, has a book on Bonhoeffer entitled Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Theologian of Reality. There is not a total consensus, but I think that there is some kind of emerging consensus, maybe, among Bonhoeffer scholars that reality is a good way to get a handle on him. Now, if I were to kind of sum up what I think Bonhoeffer is about, I think that can be done in a lot of ways. And I've already said that I'm on the side of those people who see essential continuity rather than radical change. I'm also on the side of those people who see the focus in reality. So in a way, I've already said what I think Bonhoeffer is about. Well, let's take another run at it. I think that Bonhoeffer is a radical theologian in the sense that he asks the radical questions. The radical questions being the root questions, okay? Radical means root. He is not interested in fussing around on the periphery. He's not interested in asking questions of interest only to some few fellow academics. He asks the question, who is Jesus Christ for us today? That's a root question. That's a radical question. There aren't so many theologians who ask that question. They ask all kinds of little questions all over the place. He asks the question, what is Christianity? That's what I want to know. Most of us don't dare ask that question, because if we ask that question, someone says, what? You don't know what Christianity is, you idiot? But Bonhoeffer is constantly coming back to the centers, constantly coming back to the hub of the wheel, constantly asking that root question. And so he's a radical theologian in that sense. He is at the same time a very conservative theologian, if one considers conservative to be one who is at work conserving the faith, conserving the tradition, keeping the faith, digging in the scriptures, returning to the confessions and the creeds of the church, so that he is conservative in the sense that he is not sitting down thinking, what cute thing can I say about God today, or how can I make the gospel relevant? Bonhoeffer just blows a fuse on that phrase. He says, you don't make the gospel relevant. The gospel is relevant. If you don't believe that, you're not on the team. The question is, what is the gospel? So he's coming back and back again to that question. So if we take, for instance, the root theological question as being what is a Christian? One could say, what is the gospel? What is Christianity? Well, let's say, what is a Christian? And the root ethical question as being, what does a Christian do? Then I think you can encapsulate Bonhoeffer's position in the responses. What is a Christian? Bonhoeffer would respond, these aren't his words, they're mine, but he'd like them, I think. To the question, what is a Christian? The sentence, a Christian confesses Jesus Christ concretely. That is to say, Bonhoeffer doesn't want anything to do with behavioral definitions of a Christian. You cannot say what a Christian is by saying a Christian is ABC, kind, true, beautiful, etc. Huh? A Christian is one who confesses. That's a big word for him. You remember that he comes into and out of the confessing church in Germany. Against the German Christians, the confessing church people said, this isn't the time for a nice theological discussion over tea. The German Christians are apostate. They are not offering a nice theological option. They're rejecting Jesus Christ. And in that context, the only thing appropriate is to confess Jesus Christ. And to confess him concretely, that means in this time and in this place. And it is not enough simply to mouth the confession from a former time, although Bonhoeffer is constantly rooted in those confessions. But we have to do that in this place and in this time, and for Bonhoeffer that means to say, for instance, Jesus Christ is a Jew, and one has to say that in Nazi Germany, and that's what the Barman Confession says. So to be a Christian is to confess Jesus Christ concretely. What does a Christian do? I think it's possible to put together Bonhoeffer's life and thought in the phrase, a Christian follows Jesus Christ concretely. That is to say, Bonhoeffer blows as much of a fuse on the phrase imitation of Christ as he would on a behavioral definition of the Christian. Bonhoeffer says we don't imitate, we're never asked to imitate Jesus Christ. The phrase is used, I think, only once in the New Testament in that way, and Paul says in Ephesians, be imitators of God. The phrase imitation of Christ, which comes down to us from Thomas a Kempis and a whole tradition of that way of thinking about the Christian life, is not a New Testament phrase. The New Testament phrase is to follow Jesus Christ, and that means there's always a distance. I'm not Jesus, and I'm a follower of Jesus. And that means that the Christian life, for me, is going to require maybe some different kinds of things from what are required for Jesus Christ. I'm not going to die on the cross for the sins of the world. Jesus Christ did not worry about ecological problems in the same way that we have to. So I follow Jesus Christ, and that's a little more complicated than imitating, but I follow him concretely, that is, not simply in formulating general rules or values or norms or something. I follow him concretely in specific times and specific places. In one beautiful passage, Bonhoeffer's talking about the Christian life, and he asks, what is the sacrament of the ethical? He says, what is the sacrament of the law? We have baptism, and we have the Lord's Supper as the sacrament of the gospel. That's the grace that comes to us in Jesus Christ. And we have water, we have bread, we have wine. There is a visible, touchable, smellable, tastable stuff through which God communicates his grace. But what is the sacrament of the ethical? What is the sacrament of the law? And Bonhoeffer says the sacrament of the law, the sacrament of the ethical, is the concrete situation. So that this place, this set of circumstances, these people, this moment, that'll never return again, that is touchable and smellable and tastable, this material situation is the sacrament of the ethical, as the bread and the wine is the sacrament of grace. So I follow Jesus Christ concretely, not in some other place and some other time, but in this place and this time. So that's a kind of a way, it seems to me, at least it's a way in which I have tried to put together some various elements, and I think that's some kind of key, at least for me, to Bonhoeffer ethics. So how does that work out? Well, I think that when one talks about Bonhoeffer's ethics, one could do that in all kinds of ways. One could, for instance, just read the biography. Baitke has a 1,000-page biography of Bonhoeffer, which is a magnificent volume. If you're interested in that period of history, even if you don't care about Bonhoeffer, you'd love that book. It's absolutely magnificent. And one could ask, what is the ethics of Bonhoeffer? And one could read his life and come to some conclusions about what his ethics are, because he was one of those rare people who did what he said, and he said what he did. There aren't many of those people around, and so you can do his ethics, you can read it off of his life, or you can go through the letters, the correspondence, the notes. You can go through term papers that he did at Union Seminary when he was a student there. You can go through little lectures that he gave when he was a student intern, a vicar, at a little German congregation in Barcelona, in which, incidentally, he has a nice little lecture that he gave to maybe 8 people or something like that in the church basement there on ethics. You can go through all of those writings, and you can come to some conclusions about what Bonhoeffer's ethics are. He has a marvelous little thing, for instance, on the beginning of an exposition of Psalm 119. If you know Psalm 119, it's all about the law. And you might think, this guy isn't interested in the law at all. He's interested in all following Jesus in the concrete situation. What does law have to do with that? It has everything to do with that, but with all kinds of new twists. And so he regarded it as one of the great tasks of his life to write an exposition of Psalm 119 about the law. That's very interesting. You could read Cost of Discipleship. We Lutherans have gathered like eagles round the carcass of cheap grace, and there have drunk the poison which has killed the life of following Christ. Only he who believes obeys, semicolon, only he who obeys believes. And an exposition on the Sermon on the Mount. So there are lots of places to which one can go, and what we're going to do now is to just look at a book entitled Ethics. But that's just a little piece of it. Huh? If you really want to get at Bonhoeffer's ethics, you have to look at his whole life. You have to look at all his writings. This is just a book, and it's not a book. It's a non-book, as a matter of fact. He wanted to write a book on ethics. He started it four different times. After he died, some of the pieces were stuffed under the eaves of a house someplace, and they found that, and they found us. Some other manuscripts, some other places, and Eberhard Beke, his friend, put those together and called the book Ethics. But it's not a book, it's a collection of four starts at attempting to begin to write a book on ethics. So when you read that thing, I think that it's better, really, to pick around and read a little here and read a little there and soak in it a little bit and pick up something else. If you start at the beginning and read to the end, it might get a little heavy at times and it might even get a little confusing. So what I'd like to do is to mention some places where I think you might begin to read to get some feel for what Bonhoeffer is doing when he thinks about the Christian life. Okay. I'm going to give you page numbers from the paperback edition. There are many editions of this book, and I'm going to give you some page references, but I'll also give you the titles of the sections. And this is from a section entitled Thinking in Terms of Two Spheres. It is, for me, the best window into the entire Bonhoeffer phenomenon. I don't think there's another passage in any of his writings that is so transparent as this particular section. So if you were wondering, I've never read a word of Bonhoeffer, where should I begin? I'd say read Thinking in Terms of Two Spheres in the Ethics. Okay, he says things like this. In Christ, we are offered the possibility of partaking in the reality of God and in the reality of the world, but not in one without the other. The reality of God discloses itself only by setting me entirely in the reality of the world. And when I encounter the reality of the world, it is always already sustained, accepted, and reconciled in the reality of God. And that's what Jesus Christ means. Okay? He rings the changes on that theme, says it over and over again in many different ways. And what he is saying is that the whole religious, and religion is a negative word for Bonhoeffer, as it is, I think, for Luther and Karl Barth, a number of other people. The whole religious mentality splits up God and world, and soul and body, and church and society, and clergy and laity, into two spheres, Renaissance and Reformation. Cathedral and village. Bonhoeffer says the Word really did become flesh. Didn't look like flesh, didn't just appear to be flesh. The Word became flesh in Jesus Christ. World and God come together in Jesus Christ so that there is no world without God, there's no God without world. Christians are people who find God in the events of the Exodus and the incarnation and the cross and the resurrection, which are worldly events. They do not find God by leaving the world. They find God by embracing the world, focused in those events in which God has made himself known. Hmm? So that is a radical point of view. And for religious people, for two-sphere thinking people, it requires a whole transformation of thinking about God and world in order to get inside of that thing. And I think that that is a good place to begin with Bonhoeffer. And as a matter of fact, when I wrote that little intro it for last night, Bonhoeffer didn't say that, but that's Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Huh? The village doesn't equal a cathedral. God doesn't equal the world. That'd be pantheism. Hmm? You have to distinguish, but you better not separate. Okay? Or you don't have Christianity. That's one place I would like to direct you. Another place.
Is that a page reference in there?
190. Yeah, the passage that I read is actually on page 195, which just immediately precedes the section thinking in terms of two spheres. There is a section entitled "The Natural" in this book, and that's another beautiful section. Bonhoeffer says it is really. It is really a strange and unchristian thing, it's an unbiblical thing, that somehow or another we have allowed the word natural to mean sinful. In the Confession of Sin, in the Lutheran liturgy, we say we are by nature sinful and unclean. Hmm? Now, what that really means is that we are conditionally sinners as well as actually sinners. Not only do we do sins, but we are sinners. We are by nature sinful and unclean, and we have sinned against thee by thought, word, and deed. Okay? That's what that means. We are sinners, and we commit sin. But that word natural in there gives us the idea somehow or another that our problem is that we're human beings. Our problem is that we're part of nature. And so in order to get close to God, we have to get out of the natural and into the supernatural. And that's that two-sphere thinking all over again. So Bonhoeffer says, if we're going to get rid of that two-sphere thinking stuff, which we have to do if we really know who Jesus is, then we have to recover the notion of the natural. So he talks about, he's got a section in here, The Natural. This is page 144, and it's from a section entitled The Natural. He says, the concept of the natural must, therefore, be recovered on the basis of the gospel. We speak of the natural as distinct from the creaturely in order to take into account the fact of the fall. And we speak of the natural rather than of the sinful so that we may include in it the creaturely. The natural is that which, after the fall, is directed toward the coming of Christ. The unnatural is that which, after the fall, closes its doors against the coming of Christ. Did that make any sense to you? Bonhoeffer says, the polar word for natural is not supernatural. So we're always trying to get out of the natural and the supernatural. The polar word is the unnatural. He distinguishes the natural from the creaturely. We aren't as Adam and Eve were created. Sin has entered the world. The natural includes that. But that doesn't mean that it's equivalent to the sinful. So he distinguishes it from creaturely and sinful. Then he says, the natural is that which after the fall, and we all live after the fall, the natural is that which after the fall moves in the direction of Christ's coming, that is, in the direction of what God is doing for his world. It's natural. We have to be redeemed to be natural, but it's natural to go with God in this world toward the purpose which he is working in this world. It's unnatural to oppose God's purpose. Now, that's a radical revision of that term. But it is moving it into a time history framework rather than a space to sphere framework. Is that okay? We can come back to that if you want. That's another basic category. Another is when he talks about the command of God, and Bonhoeffer is constantly working at seeing things in the context of grace. And there are commands all over the Bible. There are imperatives. There are laws. Do this, do that. But Bonhoeffer says, if we understand God as grace, then the law is not negative, but the law is a way in which God chooses to be gracious to us. It is a way in which he allows us to be natural, that is, to go with God in the world. He says, look, I made the place. Here's some clues about how to live there. That's really neat. So the command of God, Bonhoeffer says, grants permission to live. Here's a section. This is on page 283. The command of God permits man to be man before God. Not just man to be man, but man to be man before God. Don't forget that. It allows the flood of life to flow freely. It lets man eat, drink, sleep, work, rest, and play. It does not interrupt him. It does not continually ask him whether he ought to be sleeping, eating, working, or playing, or whether he has some more urgent duties. Some of you have read Life Together. You remember where he says that the church doesn't exist to be constantly taking its spiritual pulse. Some Christians just get completely immobilized because they think the big thing is to obey God's command. And I was wondering, am I doing it or not? Fritz Norstedt, who's coming up here in September, some of you know, told me long years ago that, I have no way of checking this out, but this is what he said. He's been in hospital for many years. He said that there is a correlation between legalistic religion and being in the orthopedic ward. Some of you MDs may, think there's a lot of garbage, and maybe it is. Maybe it is. But he said it's just as plain true that legalistic people tend to be uptight, and that's not just a psychological thing. That's a thing that affects one's muscles, You're walking, you say, should I be crossing the street or shouldn't? Maybe I shouldn't. Maybe God wants me to do this, God wants me to do that. All of a sudden, boom, a car hits you while you're trying to figure out, what to do, where to go. Bonhoeffer says, the command of God grants permission to live. The command of God is gracious. It allows the flood of life to flow freely. It does not interrupt. It does not say whether he ought to be sleeping, eating, working, playing, or whether he has some more urgent duties. It does not make a man a constant critic and judge of himself. This is, if you listen to Carol Hinderly very much, I don't know if he's read this passage, but you hear the same stuff coming all the time. It does not make a man a constant critic and judge of himself and of his deeds, but it allows him to live and to act with certainty and with confidence in the guidance of the divine commandment. Luther said the same thing. Luther said the Christian lives not in security, but in the certainty of faith. The self-tormenting and hopeless question regarding the purity of one's motives, the suspicious observation of oneself, the glaring and fatiguing light of incessant consciousness, all of these have nothing to do with the commandment of God who grants liberty to live and to act. The command of God grants permission to live. Ah, that's a beautiful phrase. And it's very basic to Bonhoeffer's ethics. Another
the Ten Commandments, commandments or guides.
Barthes would say, Bonhoeffer would agree, I would also agree, that a good way of talking about the law, including the Ten Commandments, is that the law is a form of the gospel whose content is grace. That's a very un-Lutheran thing to say. Couldn't we come back? It's all right, pardon me.
Well, I was just going to say, the way Luther puts it, right at the top, I am the Lord your God. This is pure grace. This is gospel. And then it seems to me one must conclude the commandments are illustrative guidelines.
Okay, we'd have to talk a while about what guidelines mean.
Yeah. Well,
guidelines can be interpreted very, very legalistically, very graciously. I think Luther blew it by simply saying, I am the Lord thy God. The text says, I am the Lord thy God who brought thee out of Egypt. The grace that is pumped into the Ten Commandments does not come from God's being, but from his redemptive action in bringing his people out of Egypt.
And those followers that you're God.
Well, you can read that back. But I think that it's inexcusable that Luther cut off that sentence. The God of the Old Testament is not a God who just is, but who does. He is the God who led his people out of Egypt. And I think that's unfortunate that Luther dropped that. And the graciousness of the commandments flow out of God's gracious redemptive act in the Exodus. Another passage that is, I think, a place where you might go to get at the nub of Luther's talk is a passage entitled The Acceptance of Guilt. It's very typical Bonhoeffer stuff. It's in the paperback edition. It's on page 240. I'm going to read a section from page 241. If it is responsible action, if it is action which is concerned solely and entirely with the other person, if it arises from selfless love for the real man, you notice that real reality thing, for the real man who is our brother, then precisely because this is so, it cannot wish to shun the fellowship of human guilt. Jesus took upon himself the guilt of all men, and for that reason every man who acts responsibly becomes guilty. If any man tries to escape guilt and responsibility, he detaches himself from the ultimate reality of human existence. And what is more, he cuts himself off from the redeeming mystery of Christ bearing guilt without sin, and he has no share in the divine justification which lies upon this event. He sets his own personal innocence above his responsibility for men. What's more important, responsibility for people or personal innocence? Bonhoeffer says, to set one's personal innocence above responsibility, that's what sin is about. And such a person is blind to the more irredeemable guilt which he incurs precisely in this. He is blind also to the fact that real innocence, playing with those words, shows itself precisely in a man's entering into the fellowship of guilt for the sake of other men. Through Jesus Christ, it becomes an essential part of responsible action that the man who is without sin loves selflessly and for that reason incurs guilt. What that means is that to live in God's real world, which is thoroughly screwed up by sin, means that there are never pure options. To be responsible is to be willing to get one's hands dirty. To be involved in a guilt-ridden situation for the sake of redeeming that situation. One of the reasons, I think, that we've had as few people in politics as we have is that somehow or another we've gotten the impression that to be a Christian is to extract oneself from the real world into that other supernatural sphere where one can have clean hands. Jesus Christ took upon himself the guilt of the world, and the one who follows Jesus Christ is going to be involved in some very, very messy situations, because it's a very, very messy world. And so he talks about the command of God in terms of the acceptance of guilt. It's a beautiful passage. I was going to mention a number of other things and to read a number of other passages. Let me just mention one and then read one poem, and we'll have some time for questions and comments. A very important part of Bonhoeffer's ethics is what he calls the mandates. Some of you know that classic Orthodox, both Lutheran and Reformed ethics talked about the orders of creation. And the orders of creation is kind of a Protestant equivalent to Roman Catholic natural law theory, which is a whole way of saying that God has made his creation in an orderly way, and that if we are going to obey him, we better find out something about the way in which the world is structured. So natural law theory tends to do that. In Protestant ethics, they've talked about the orders of creation, and the orders of creation are generally talked about as the state, the family, the church, that those are structures that are, quote, ordained by God, that he doesn't want us to live in isolation from one another, but in community with one another, and he's even given us some structures for those communities. Well, the problem, there are many wonderful things about that, the problem with orders of creation talk got to be that people tended to freeze those orders into a particular kind of structure, and read, for instance, Romans 13, obey the powers that be, for they are ordained by God. The state is an order of creation. It's ordained by God. It's part of that supernatural world dropped into our natural world. Therefore, you obey the government, period. For Bonhoeffer, you can never do that, because there is not that supernatural world above. We live in the real world, the concrete world, which is always messed up, and those orders are also messed up. The state is ordained by God, but it's not only ordained by God. It is also messed up because of human sin. Therefore, one must make decisions about whether, in this concrete instance, to obey the government or to start a revolution. And so it might be the case that someone would think, well, what Bonhoeffer would do in that Nazi Germany situation would be to just simply throw out the notion completely. He's a radical theologian. But he's a radical theologian in that he asks the root questions, and he's always conservative in that he goes back to the scriptures, the confessions, the creeds. So what he winds up doing is not throwing stuff out, but reshaping it. And so Bonhoeffer talks about the mandates, the divine mandates. And the mandates are the church, the state, the family. Sometimes he talks about labor. It's all there. But he calls them mandates because he wants to pump some concreteness into that notion. He wants to pump some immediacy with the will of God into that notion. He wants to say that those things don't just exist by themselves, like a watch that's made by the Creator and wound up to run by itself, but it is a way in which God orders from one situation to the next his creation. So he talks about the divine mandates, and finding out the will of God for Bonhoeffer is never an individual trying to get some direct pipeline to God. It is always in the context of the community. It's always in the context of the divine mandates. I'm going to read this poem, Stations on the Way to Freedom. I guess I won't. I'll read the second stanza, which is entitled Action. The whole thing is here in a few lines. Do and dare what is right, not swayed by the whim of the moment. Bravely take hold of the real, not dallying now with what might be. Not in the flight of ideas, but only in action is freedom. Make up your mind and come out into the tempest of living. God's command is enough, and your faith in him to sustain you. Then, at last, freedom will welcome your spirit amid great rejoicing. It's entitled Stations on the Way to Freedom, and Baitke puts it as a preface to the book on ethics. It's also in the Letters and Papers from Prison. Well, what would you like to say or ask?
What happened in the prison setting? You mentioned that he was said to have changed at the very end, and you mentioned yesterday that he lied his head off.
Yes.
Can you put that together?
There was, Bonhoeffer was arrested. He got into this military intelligence organization through some relatives. The military intelligence, the Abwehr, was riddled with resistance people. The Nazis undoubtedly knew that, but they didn't know everything about it. So they picked up these people one by one, and they picked up Bonhoeffer in April, I think it was, of 1943. He went to the Tegel prison, which was a military prison. It's very important to know that in Nazi Germany, the Nazis, per se, were a small part, of course, of the population. And there was a double military structure. The Nazi structure had its Gestapo, the secret police, and the military also had its intelligence. And Bonhoeffer was working for the military intelligence, and his uncle was commandant of the city of Berlin, as a matter of fact. So he was put into a military prison, not a Gestapo prison. And he had a great deal of freedom there, and people came and visited him, Karl Barth, Senma Scar, all kinds of stuff. And he wrote these letters. He made friends with the with his guards, and they smuggled out letters. And it was a fairly nice time. There was July 20th, 1944, there was an abortive attempt on Hitler's life. Bonhoeffer was in prison at the time, but he was very much involved with those people. And after that abortive attempt on Hitler's life, they started to interrogate like crazy to find out who were those people. And Bonhoeffer was not about to tell them, so he was lying to them. And they didn't know that he knew. But after a while, they either knew that he knew or they guessed that he knew, and they transferred him then to a Gestapo prison in Berlin, Prinz Albertstrasse, and he was later transferred to Buchenwald and other concentration camps, and finally killed at Flossenbürg. But what happened in those 2 years of prison was that, according to me, Bonhoeffer kept on doing what he'd been doing before. He kept on reading the Bible and praying, and not all the time. Once in a while, he'd say, "Gee, I haven't read the Bible for a week." What amazes me is that I didn't miss it. Some people think, "See, he quit reading the Bible." No, he didn't. He went for a week, and he noticed it. Huh? I mean, that's a pretty good Bible reader. Huh? In reflecting upon the faith. April 30th, 1944, he first used the phrase non-religious Christianity. And some people think that means abandoning God. What it means is Christian Christianity as over against religious Christianity. That is, it is another way of saying not two-sphere thinking. That's religious Christianity. But non-religious Christianity is embracing the enfleshed Word in Jesus Christ, where God and world come together. So lots of things happen in prison, but theologically that's kind of... Yeah?
There's another book which, I don't know whether you've heard or how you acted, is Mary Bozanke's
yes.
biography. It might be easier for those who can't find 1,000 pages difficult.
Yes.
German scholar style.
Mary Beausanquet is a British journalist, and she has a book entitled The Life and Death, I think it is, of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and that's about 350 pages. It's a nice book, and a lot of the same material. I think, over-psychologizes the situation. She tries to find a red thread running through his life of hubris and pride, and is constantly saying, well, now he moves a little bit more away from that. I think that's a little fakey, but it's that doesn't really in any way destroy the book. I think it's a good book. Another book is by William Koons, entitled In Pursuit of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. That's in paper. I don't think Beausanquet is. Koons is in paper, and that's, again, about 300 pages, and it's a nice little biography.
While you may set aside the title Imitation of Christ, I don't think Bonhoeffer himself was set aside much of the substance in that book.
I think that the substance gets filtered, however. I think that it's a little bit tricky in that Imitation of Christ, I think, has a kind of monastic flavor to it. And Bonhoeffer himself, before he returned to Germany from England, made it a point to visit Anglican monasteries. And he incorporated into the life together at Finkenwalde many disciplines that he found in those monasteries. And he wrote part of the ethics in a Benedictine monastery at Ethel in Bavaria. So it's never for Bonhoeffer that anything is thrown out, but it gets a new flavor. It is put through a new filter. And he does specifically speak against the notion of imitation. But certainly the content of that book isn't thrown out, but it does get refiltered. And the focus is not the development of my piety or anything like that. It gets to be rather the involvement of myself in God's world and in responsible action. Yeah.
Is it his statement that there is no God without this world?
Yes.
Do you have any problems with that?
Yeah, I think that. I think that there are no riskless theological sentences. I think that's true in journalism and physics and everything else. But language is always designed to do some work, and one has to ask, what work does one want done by that sentence, so that it's not possible in a given formula to cover all the bases or to protect all the ditches. It kind of depends on what one is worried about. And in this section, thinking in terms of two spheres, Bonhoeffer is worried about religionizing Christianity. And so he rails against that two-sphere thing. And he does say, no world without God. That means God made the whole world. There isn't an atom anywhere in the universe that God didn't make. So there's no world without God. But he also turns it around and says, no God without world. What he means by that is, and Luther would say the same thing, the only God we know and proclaim is the God who has made himself known in his historical redemptive events, focusing on the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. So that Christians are not those who say God is a great mystery or God is the great unknown or something like this. Christians are people who proclaim the God whom they do know, and what they know is not something that they've speculated about, but the God that they know is that God who is identified with the world. So that's what no God without world means. Of course, if one pushed that too hard, then one would wind up in pantheism, where the tree equals God. And Bonhoeffer checks himself against that, but not in the passage that I read. So one has to, you know, finally begin to qualify a little bit. But the point that the God we proclaim as the God who has made himself known in this world, that's a terribly important thing to say.
He doesn't reject the concept that God pre-existed the world.
No, no.
It's only in our relationship with God that the two come together. We can't live in some sort of a spiritual nirvana above, apart, and beyond the world.
Well, right, but I think he would also, Bonhoeffer is in a way a Christ-intoxicated man. He things are funneled into the Christ event. He is not particularly interested in pre-existence. He's not particularly interested in final speculation. The thing is reality in this world created and redeemed by God in Christ. So one has to check against pantheism. And some people do that by talking about panentheism, which is an embracing of God and world and God without making the two identical.
I guess what I meant to say is he really wasn't addressing the concept of pre-existence at this point at all. It was in terms of our relationship.
No, although he would not deny that. And he rings the changes on Colossians 1:15 through 20, for instance. He loves that passage. Well, you probably it's a few minutes before 12. I don't think that Ethics is the first book to read, although I think that little section, Thinking in Terms of Two Spheres, is the first thing to read. But I would certainly read Life Together before I read this. I think I would read the preface to Cost of Discipleship before I read this. But when you do get to this, here are some sections where you can begin and then pick around and see what you like, but don't just start with page 1 and read to the end, I think. Thanks.